I'm Greg Dalton, and today on Climate One, we're talking about cleaning up capitalism. Burning fossil fuels is driving severe weather that is hitting economies around the world. Yet global subsidies of dirty energy hit $500 billion in 2012. $500 billion. Many companies and countries are moving to switch from running on fumes to running on the sun, plants, and other clean energy. But that transition is not happening fast enough to stabilize the Earth's operating system that enables the global economy. Over the next hour, we'll discuss the cost of our addiction to dirty fuels and the rights of poor countries as well as future generations. Joining our live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, we're pleased to welcome the distinguished economist Nicholas Stern. Lord Stern is chairman of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at the London School of Economics. He's president of the British Academy and a former chief economist of the World Bank. Lord Stern is here today to receive the 2013 Stephen Schneider Award for Outstanding Climate Science Communication, presented by Climate One, in memory of the late Stanford climatologist Stephen Schneider. Please welcome Lord Stern to Climate One. Lord Stern, welcome to Climate One.
Thank you, Greg.
You're a famous economist. We're going to talk about the global economy, but I first want to ask you a question about my car. I got this 13-year-old car, and it's European, not American. They make it's not British, sorry. Runs on gasoline, kind of dirty. My family's used to it. I'd like to buy an electric car, but the technology's changing. I'd like the price to come down a little bit. What should I do with my car? Should I keep running it for a little while, or should I switch to something, the new technology?
Well, since this is NPR, I can always call Car Talk and get some...
You like that? Yeah, that. My son loves exactly. Yeah. A lot of car talk in my house, yes.
But I wouldn't anticipate what answer you might get. But those timing questions do bear thinking about. I had an old car which was nearly 20 before it fell apart. And so my question was, do I buy my Prius now, or do I wait a bit and perhaps it will be a better one? And I did some back of the envelope stuff on what scrapping the car a bit earlier would cost relative to scrapping it a bit later. And those are the kinds of things that are worth doing. Because technical progress is changing so rapidly, is changing what's possible so rapidly, it may be that you should just wait a little bit, scrap it later on, and buy something that's really super efficient. But it depends on how fast you think your car's going to fall apart. And I wouldn't dream of telling you the answer to that question.
Well, economies face the same question about how to invest in the cost of doing something today versus a future cost. You wrote a very famous economic report, the Stern Review. But tell us the headline of that, for the cost of doing something today versus the cost of doing something in the future, and how we ought to look at that.
Well, the headline was that the cost of inaction is much bigger than the cost of action. In other words, the damage we do by waiting in terms of build-up of greenhouse gases is likely to be much bigger than the investment costs that we have to incur now. And to get that kind of answer, you have to turn to the science to try to understand what the costs of inaction are going to be. You have to look at the investments and how much they're going to cost. But even putting aside questions of how rapidly we're going to learn, even including the great uncertainties in the whole system, that answer, the cost of inaction, is much bigger than the cost of action, is pretty robust to any sort of reasonable assumptions that you ought to put in.
I noted that there's $500 billion in subsidies for fossil fuels every year. Do we know how much climate disruption is costing the global economy today?
Actually, the number might be a bit bigger than that, because there's a recent study by the IMF published this spring.
The fossil fuel subsidy is bigger than $500 billion?
Yeah. If you look at those are really the explicit ones. If you look at the implicit ones through letting people use their appliances, their cars, their heating, without paying for the damage they do, as Steve Schneider said, if you allow people to use the atmosphere as a sewer, essentially you're not charging them for the damage that they're doing. You would normally expect to pay for wastewater because it's a cost to manage it, but you're not paying for the carbon dioxide greenhouse gases you're throwing into the atmosphere. And the IMF quite rightly said, well, that's a subsidy. Letting people to do something for nothing when that something is damaging, that's correctly counted as a subsidy. There's all the congestion associated when you use your cars and slow other people down by using your cars. So the IMF quite properly took a broader view of what constitutes a subsidy, and they came to a much larger figure than that. So the subsidy essentially direct and through these processes of not charging for people causing damage, those subsidies are really very, very large. And the damage that comes, now the damage that comes is not immediate. The damage comes with lags. But if you look at the damage that is going on, it is much bigger than the kinds of numbers that we're talking about in this case. But what we can say is those kinds of numbers that we've described, half a trillion or a trillion, would lead to a tremendous amount of investment that could radically reduce the risk. So I would make those two comparisons. One comparison with the damage that's being done by the greenhouse gas emissions that encourages, but also with the kind of investment costs that are necessary. And you could do a great deal with $1 trillion a year. It may be $1 trillion a year is about the extra investment that we would need. It's a little over 1% of world GDP, $1 trillion, world GDP 70 or 80 trillion. It's the kind of number which captures the investment we need. So instead of throwing it at hydrocarbons, if you put it much more sensibly and much more measured way into the right kind of investment, that itself would give you the kind of scalar response that you need.
So the money's there, it's a matter of reallocating it. About 4 years ago, the G20 group of countries in Pittsburgh pledged to reduce fossil fuel subsidies. Is that happening at all, or is that just talk from heads of state?
It's happening slowly. In China, they're starting to move prices to more reasonable levels. There's some charging for carbon, and in other words, removing the implicit subsidy of letting people pollute for nothing. There's some movement, but my guess is that that number has not been radically reduced.
So as an economist, there's a couple ways to go. There's to make brown energy more expensive or to make green energy less expensive. Which is the better way?
You've got to do a bit of each. You should certainly charge people for the damage they do. This is about getting markets to work. And the language we used in the Stern Review is that abandoning or having no policy of any serious strength on climate change is essentially to do nothing about the biggest market distortion, the biggest market failure the world has ever seen. So it's very important to see the role of the market here, where if we tax carbon, if we regulate, if we have carbon markets, whatever method we might use or combination of methods we're using, what we're doing is trying to make the market work better. Because if people see the damage that they do in the incentives that they face, they'll make decisions which are much better for the world as a whole. So this is about making markets work well, and you've got to face people with the damage that they do. I mean, if you go and buy a meal, you expect to pay for the food, you expect to pay for the space in the restaurant if you're eating out. You expect to pay for the costs that arise because of your action. If you're not paying for the costs that arise because of your action, here, the emission of greenhouse gases, you're going to do too much of that thing. And that's a market failure. So correcting that market failure is fundamental. So you've got to tax the damage or have regulation on the damage that's being done. At the same time, these other technologies are in a very early stage. If I try out some renewable, if it fails or if it succeeds, other people learn from the investments and actions that I've been taking. So that is a benefit for other people, that kind of discovery. So there's very powerful economic reasons, both for taxing the dirty stuff and for encouraging the newer, more experimental stuff that we're learning about. And both arguments sound economics based on trying to get market signals right. So this story of, in this case, let's call it, say we do it through the carbon tax, on the one side, and encouraging, say, renewables on the other, to accelerate that learning process, both those things are market-friendly actions. You need both of them. There are very sound economic reasons for doing both of them.
Then why are so many companies against it, and they would say that it'll raise the cost of energy, it'll hurt people, it'll hurt jobs, it'll hurt the economy?
What you're doing is switching over from one kind of activity to another kind of activity. So there's some dislocation in that process. But we've already seen in the United States, for example, the jobs in renewables are much bigger than, say, the jobs in coal, much bigger. So what you've got to do is ask, are you going to encourage this move or are you going to encourage that move? There's going to be change. There's going to be dislocation. But when you try to answer that question, what you've got to focus on is what the benefit over the medium term is going to be and what kind of dislocation there's going to be over the short term and how you manage it. But we've now happily moved to a point where the kind of jobs you see in renewables are rather bigger than the jobs you see elsewhere. So trying to switch back would actually be more disruptive than keeping going down a path which is going to lead to real returns, real discovery for everybody in the longer term.
If this is so clearly logical, then why isn't it happening? Is it a failure of the political system?
I think most of the delay, and delay is extremely dangerous in this context, most of the delay is down to absence of political will. And we can see that arising from a number of sources. The recession has diverted attention. I mean, I don't know how many ideas politicians can keep in their head at one time. But
re-election.
It seems it's limited. And, you know, if you have a huge crisis of the kind we did have, that has consumed attention and diverted it away from the still bigger medium-term problems as a result of climate change. You've got quite an effective creation of doubt and uncertainty from climate deniers, and they've run a pretty good campaign. I mean, a dishonest and disreputable campaign, but they've run it quite effectively. You've got opposition from those who have strong vested interests in the in that area. So these are the kinds of reasons, I think, why we've moved so slowly and why the political will is not nearly as strong as it should be. And of course, that turns the spotlight onto the question of how do you stimulate that political will or get people to tune into this program is one.
And the translation of public opinion, which supports some action on climate, the public opinion is not translated into political will. Some think that's a test of democracy, a failure of political systems. What do you think?
I think it's also, we have to look at ourselves and ask ourselves, have we done a good enough job at communicating? I mean, we need a lot more Steve Schneiders to tell the story well. We need serious teaching in schools, and I do think that it's improving around the world, the teaching in schools, so that young people get a chance to look quietly at the message. They're not just seeing it coming at them in sort of snippets here and there, because it does take a little time to think about those issues. But it also needs leadership, and it needs leaders who are going to say, I've looked ahead, this is of great importance, this is the way we should go. So it's a combination of pressure from people who see the issues clearly, and it's our job to help clarity in that analysis, but it needs to come from the top as well. And there have been moments, 5, 6, 7 years ago, where it looked as if that leadership was coming on quite strongly, but then I think it faded, particularly around the story of the recession.
One person involved in the UK government, Owen Paterson, is the Environment Secretary. He plays down climate change, and he even called climate scientists irresponsible and immoral. So what's your view of the Cameron government on this issue?
Well, I would invite Mr. Paterson, if he's discovered new results in science to overturn 200 years of serious work, he should send them immediately to the scientific journals. I mean, he's also the gentleman that blamed the badgers for moving the goalposts when their attempt to cull the badgers didn't work very well in the UK. So I'm not sure his scientific credentials are terribly strong.
Who is a climate leader in the UK or in Europe right now?
Well, there isn't, I don't think, outstanding leadership on climate at the overall political level. In the big countries, I think it's fair to say that the Northern European, Scandinavian countries have been pretty steady on this issue.
Sweden's had a carbon tax since the 70s. They learned the lesson of the first oil shock.
Of over 100 euro, well over $100 a ton of CO2. And, you know, Denmark, Sweden, Norway have been cutting their emissions. So I would point there to the leadership. But looking forward, what we'd like to see is the Angela Merkel of 2007. She was a real leader in 2007, got the EU to move strongly to the targets of cutting by 20% Europe's emissions between 1990 and 2020. She's a nuclear scientist. She understands the arguments. This coalition that she's now forming with the Social Democrats, the so-called Grand Coalition, the Social Democrats will be led by Sigmar Gabriel. I'm sorry to burden you with European politics here, but it is important. He was a former environment minister under the previous Grand Coalition with Angela Merkel at that time. So it's possible that Germany could reinvigorate the leadership. So what we need is the Angela Merkel of 2007.
And what about U.S. leadership? John McCain was a leader in 2005. That's changed. President Obama is not as solid as he once was on this issue.
Like many of you, I still remember that speech in Chicago on the night of the first election, where I think it was Alice Nixon Cooper, who was 106 or something, and he asked the question, what if my girls live as long as she does? What kind of planet are they going to see? And he spoke of a planet in peril as one of the key issues of the time. And it has been a bit disappointing, but I think we saw in the Georgetown speech in Georgetown University in June a recommitment for the second term. So if we have a combination of the Barack Obama in Grant Park on the night of the election and the Barack Obama of the Georgetown speech in June this year, if they go arm in arm, those two Barack Obamas, then it might start to move. But, you know, I'm not an expert on U.S. politics, and I've learned that speaking about U.S. politics in an English accent doesn't necessarily get you very far. But when I'm outside the U.S., trying to get people to understand that actually some things are happening in the U.S., You speak about California. You speak about New York's emissions per capita being half the United States and Beijing's emissions per capita being twice those of China. You speak about the Pew analysis that suggests that about half of U.S. GDP is generated in cities and states which have, you know, reasonable climate policies. So it seems to me that what you're looking for in terms of change in the United States, is cities, states, some far-sighted companies also, and actions that don't require a lot of legislation in Congress. And if I understood the the June speech in Georgetown University, that was the message that Barack Obama was offering. There's a great deal that we can do without taking legislation through Congress, and that's what we should do.
We're talking about the economics of climate change at Climate One with Nicholas Stern, an economist from the London School of Economics. I'm Greg Dalton. You've written about the waves of innovation, talking about things that don't require government action, industrial, then steam, and then steel, then oil and cars, information technology, and clean technology. So put that in perspective for us in terms of what technology can do to drive the kind of change that doesn't rely on government.
If you look back at the big waves of technological change, I mean, some people call them industrial revolutions, but waves of technological change, going back to, you know, as you described, from mechanization of textiles at the end of the 18th century and steam and railways, middle of the 19th, electricity and steel at the end of the 19th, you know, going through mass production into the 20th, and of course, information communications technology at the end of the 20th century. Well, who knows if we've even got to the middle of that one. But what you see is two, three, four decades of innovation, investment, discovery, growth. There's some things which are destroyed along the way. There's dislocation, waves of technological change. Industrial revolutions are like that. You leave some of the old stuff behind and you go on to something different. Those are very dynamic periods. Now, what we should be looking for is an energy industrial revolution with clean technologies that looks something like that. But I think the difference, of course, there are many differences between these different industrial revolutions, but if you look at this one, it does need government policy. If you can get it started, then I think we'll find that the waves of innovation and discovery will carry it forward in its own with its own momentum. I mean, looking at what's happened to the price of solar PV panels over the last 7 or 8 years, they've been cut by a factor of five, divided by five, and that came about because you had support for these installation of these kinds of technologies, which yielded a very powerful response. So once you get these things going, then it seems to me that the cost reduction can have a very powerful momentum to carry it forward. But it does need government policy to get these things going.
Well, in the information technology age, the military bought semiconductors. There was government, the U.S. Pentagon largely set the foundation for the Internet, so that there's precedent for that. I'd like to ask you about the carbon bubble. There's been a lot of talk recently about assets on the books of fossil fuel companies that their stock price implicitly is built on the expectation that those fuels will be burned and that there'll be revenue coming from that. Tell us about your view as an economist about that unburnable carbon and a possible carbon bubble.
If you take the overall hydrocarbons that are recognized as proven reserves, coal, oil, and natural gas. And if you ask the question, given those declared reserves, a lot of them, of course, in state-owned companies, quite a bit of it private companies, and you simply ask, well, take all that and burn it, what would you get? You'd get about two or three times, depending on how you do the arithmetic, you'd get two or three times what we can afford as the overall carbon budget that's left.
For a safe level in the climate.
For something like 2 degrees with a 50-50 probability.
2 degrees being the safe level of warming that states and scientists have said is a do-not-cross line.
I think it's even a bit strong to call it safe. What the scientists have said is to cross it is dangerous.
Okay.
Yeah? And I think that difference in that language is important. But if you just say, here is the stuff that's declared. If you burn it, you've got two or three times what the carbon budget is to be consistent with a roughly 50-50 chance of holding to 2 degrees. That means that either you have to have a very rapid installation of carbon capture and storage, or you have to leave half or so in the ground, or we break 2 degrees. It's just simple logic of simple basic consistency. So if the world does accelerate, as we all hope it, many of us hope it will, action to control climate change, it means that there's going to be a capital loss on those things. So I think it's very important to understand that investing in hydrocarbons is a very risky business. And if we're serious about carbon climate change, which I sincerely hope we are and we'll get more serious, then the more risky that investment in hydrocarbons is.
You chair an institute founded by a famous money manager, Jeremy Grantham. Does he invest in fossil fuels? Do you invest in fossil fuels?
I confess I don't know what Jeremy's personal portfolio looks like. He manages assets for other people, and when I don't actually invest in anything. I have a house. And I have children and grandchildren, but I don't believe I have any shares. I guess that there are one or two pension funds that I'm involved in, and they probably do invest. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have to think about what they invest in, but that's not something you can control directly.
But you say that investing in fossil fuels is a risky proposition. I interviewed the former president of Shell Oil, who was here a few weeks ago, and said he thought the stock prices of oil companies would be flat to down, partially because of this. So if that's going to happen, there's going to be an economic shock to pensioners who have stock in the S&P 500 and the FTSE, et cetera, because a lot of the market valuation of our public stock markets is in fossil fuels. And so,
yeah, but with industrial revolutions, these kind of things happen. You know, when electricity comes in, those people who've made their money on candles are not going to do so well.
Buggy whips during, yeah.
And, you know, horses and cars and this kind of thing. That's the kind of change that we don't want to be offhand or cynical and say, oh, well, so what? But we have to recognize that those kinds of changes are necessary and manage them as best we can. But not changing because some place will be dislocated is a recipe for disaster here.
What about the, you've written about green growth, and there's a billion people around the world who don't have access to energy. There's a lot of people who aspire to the Western lifestyle that you and I enjoy and everyone listening to this and in this room. Is there a right to emit? Is there a carbon, what right do people in poor countries have to grow in the way, have the material wealth that we have?
I don't think there's any right to emit. I think there's a right to development, a right to find ways of increasing your income. But to emit is to damage. I don't see that there's a right to damage. But there is, it seems to me, a right to development. I mean, when we articulate rights, we usually derive them from some notion of common humanity, some basic sense in which humans are equal. I mean, that's, after all, the way your Declaration of Independence, your constitution is based. It's trying to articulate a sense in which people are equal as common human beings, what common humanity means. It seems to me that a right to seek ways to better yourself, a right to development, would be something which we could sit down and discuss, and we'd want to articulate that, I think I would anyway, as a right. But that's not the same as a right to emit. And what we have to try to do is to break the relationship between consumption and production on the one hand and emissions on the other. Unless we do that, we're in deep trouble. I mean, if we stopped right here at 50 billion tons per annum of CO2 equivalent as world emissions, that's way above the level that's consistent with holding to 2 degrees with a 50-50 chance. You couldn't just stop. That wouldn't be anywhere near enough. You've got to bring that 50 billion tons of CO2 equivalent a year that we're emitting as a world down to well below 20 about 40 years from now. So that tells us very clearly we have to break the relationship between consumption and production on the one hand and emissions on the other. If we do that, and we can see how to do it, you know, we can see how, you know, through energy efficiency, through switching to renewables, many ways to stopping deforestation, regrading degraded forests, the whole raft of things that we can see which do help us break that relationship between consumption and production and emissions. If we do that, then we found a route to raising living standards in the around the world, and particularly in the poorest parts of the world. And that seems to me our duty as people in rich countries to help that process take place. You can't tell people, I'm sorry, fellas, before we realise the problem, we filled the atmosphere up, it's all too late, you've got to stop right there. There's no way that we should say that. There's no way that that would be equitable or decent. But what we can do is offer something much better, and is to work and with the developing countries of the world, because they'll discover lots of these things too, find ways of doing things differently.
Does that mean that rich companies have a responsibility to write checks to send money to poor countries to acquire clean technologies to develop in a cleaner way than the fossil fuel fueled industrial revolution that we benefited from?
There's a whole range of things that we in rich countries do. We should reduce our own emissions, and in so doing we'll discover ways which other people can look at and share. We should invest in R&D that's going to help that process. And I think we are obligated to help finance change in other parts of the world which are poorer than we are. But you can do that in various ways. You can do that at government level. You can do that at individual philanthropic level. But the helping of change in the developing world does seem to me to be fundamental. And that is a big part of the story. But the good news is that there are lots of options out there. I mean, let me just give you one example. There's a company called Selco in Bangalore, in Karnataka, in South India. Now, this is a major state with, a population of 50, 60 million people or more. And this company brings microfinance and small-scale solar PV and helps people to buy that solar PV and provides the microfinance. That can help them run a store. That can give light for the kids to work at night and study. It can be a major transformation in people's lives. And that's an example of the way in which good microfinance and solar, in this case solar PV, can help transform and give people access to electricity when you've got a few hundred million people in India with no access to electricity at all. So these are the kinds of ways in which you can help the whole process of movement out of poverty through ways which don't destroy the environment.
Like many countries went straight to cell phones, some countries could leapfrog over fossil fuels and go to cleaner technology. When Nelson Mandela passed away, there was some connections between, at one point, South Africa, the situation for majority rule looked hopeless, and yet he persevered and some very positive things happened. I'd like to have your thoughts on the passing of Mandela and any inspiration or lessons you took from him and what happened in South Africa and what a broader community faces in terms of moving from fossil fuels, which seems so difficult, it seems impossible.
It was a very moving thing for me. I mean, my generation in the UK, the anti-apartheid movement was absolutely central to our political activity. It was the first, for many of us, the first kind of political act that we made in the 1960s to join the demonstrations against apartheid.
President Obama said the same thing. It was his first political act.
Yeah, I'm a bit older than him.
Okay.
I was in Wembley Stadium in London to celebrate his 70th birthday, and then a few years later there was another celebration at Wembley Stadium, but this time Nelson Mandela was there. I met him personally three times, once when I was chief economist of the World Bank, and the aura and dignity, but also personal humanity, was quite extraordinary. I mean, the most extraordinary person that I've ever met, and I met him a couple of times after that. So it was a very moving few days for many of us. I mean, there are many people who knew him far better than I ever did. But the example of a common dignity. I mean, he could see the common humanity and the common dignity in the people who were oppressing him and his people. He could see how if we change our behavior, we can make an enormous difference. And he showed how to do that through very clear analytical thought. Extraordinarily intelligent man and very strong personal example. So this is the kind of common humanity, serious analysis, ability to collaborate, personal example. These are the kinds of leadership that we need on this issue. So I think it's a very significant example for all the reasons I described.
And he forgave his jailers, and I think he invited one of his jailers or police officers to his inauguration. There was a forgiveness there. Some people in the environmental movement want to villainize fossil fuel executives. Is that the right path?
No. What we have to do is to change the incentives in society, change our values, change our taxes. There are quite a lot of people in oil companies who take this issue very, very seriously indeed. Some of the big oil companies use an internal price of carbon of $30 or $40 a ton of CO2. It's a question of how we manage the change. And if we get the priorities right in society, I think the energy companies would follow through on the right kind of incentives. But what you've got to do is not only get those incentives right, but keep them credible. And what we've seen around the world, and it's been very damaging, is instability, changing of mind. You give a subsidy one day, you take it away the next. You have a carbon price in Europe up here for a while, and then suddenly you let it crash down. That kind of policy instability means you don't get an investment really to the right kind of levels of any kind. And one of the consequences of that is you see, you know, capacity start to get very near to margins in Europe where you risk blackouts and so on. So I don't think you have to see people who run this company or that company as a villain. I think what you have to do is to bring coalitions together to get the right kind of a policy to fix these market failures, as we discussed earlier on, and then the investment processes will flow. What I do think is villainous is to secretly fund dishonest treatments of science. That's a different kind of question.
And to personally attack scientists, a lot of scientists, we have some in the room here, who suffer personal attacks. Would you put that, how would you look at that?
It's unacceptable. And that is the kind of behavior which I think we should expect to get some kind of protection from. But it's very hard to design protection from that kind of abuse and death threats and so on. It's usually done surreptitiously, anonymously, and it's very difficult unsigned on the blogosphere. It's very difficult to give people that kind of protection, protect the kind of protection that you would think would be reasonable. If identifiable people physically threaten you, you'd expect the law to take its course. If a whole load of unidentifiable people threaten you, it's very hard to do that. So most scientists and some social scientists have to just carry on and keep going. And I salute those who do that. And there are some of those people in the room. They've shown enormous personal integrity, strength of character, and they just keep going. And of course, Steve Schneider was one of those.
Our guest today at Climate One is Nicholas Stern, former chief economist of the World Bank. I'm Greg Dalton. This is Climate One. There's often an elephant in the room, population. A lot of environmentalists don't like to talk about population. It's not our issue. But the reality is that consumption, the global economy, is largely a factor of how many people are burning fossil fuels, eating food, et cetera. So what's your view on population, and can anything be done about 9 billion people on the Earth by 2050?
Well, you have to look at the basics of why populations grow. And one fundamental reason is that people are living longer because various diseases have been eradicated. Many people are able to have more food and cleaner water. So I'm assuming that if we're discussing population policy, we are not discussing increasing death rates. I mean, free cigarettes for the over 50s or something would be a policy. So let's put increasing death rates to one side, at least I will, and put increasing death rates. So it then comes down to birth rates. And what causes reductions in birth rates? Well, we've seen quite extraordinary reductions in fertility over the last 35 years or so. I mean, if you look at Bangladesh, completed family size, number of children per woman, has gone down from numbers like 5.5 or 6 down to numbers like 2.5. It's amazing in about 35 years. Why? Well, we more or less understand the main reasons for that. Education of girls and women, more opportunities in the labor force for girls. Well, you hope for women, or the girls are at school. Property rights, which allow different kinds of security, lowering infant mortality rates, lowers the birth rate, and of course access to reproductive health care. Those are the 5 or 6 factors that, as far as we can understand, and I think the evidence is quite strong, account for these dramatic reductions in birth rates. Iran, quite similar figures to Bangladesh, but you see that around the world. It's dropping in India too, dropping a bit less slowly in Africa. Now, those things, reducing the infant mortality rates, offering education to girls and women, access to reproductive health care, these seem to me to be things which have very powerful arguments in their favour already. These are basic rights, particularly of women and girls, and we should be pushing those things still more strongly for all those reasons, and climate change adds a bit to that. But I think the more, in this case, the arguments on basic human rights for women and girls are so powerful that that's where we should be concentrating. The reason then that we're going to see this rise from about 7 billion now to 9 billion plus maybe in 2050 are partly because we see the life expectancy to carry on increasing, and partly because you've got a lot of women in childbearing age, and that's a follow-on from the way in which the demographics have developed. So basically, I would intensify, because they're good things anyway, action on all those dimensions that I've described. But I think you would want to argue that, even if you've never heard of climate change.
Before we go to audience questions, I want to ask you about economic growth. There's a school of thought which holds that, well, I mean, it started the Club of Rome in the 70s, had it put forward some thoughts about the constraint or the limits to growth. And some people think that because of the financial debt that's accumulated, as well as the carbon debt and resource constraints, that will put limits in the future on economic growth, which has solved lots of political and social problems in the past. What's your view on the future of growth? Will it be as robust as it has been in the past?
Probably not. But I think if we're looking at the next 30 or 40 years, you're not going to deal with the issues of climate change and cutting emissions largely through stopping growth. You've got to break the link between consumption and production on the one hand and emissions on the other. Because even if that's going back to an answer I gave earlier, even if you stopped growth right here, right now, which you couldn't do anyway, but even if you did, at 50 billion tons of CO2 equivalent per annum, we're 2.5 times where we need to be 4 decades from now. So once we move fast on cutting that, breaking that relationship between consumption, production and emissions, then it seems to me there is the opportunity, as there should be, for people in developing countries to raise their living standards. Already, something like two-thirds of the world's investment is in emerging and developing markets. So it's greening that process that seems to me to be of fundamental importance. And I think that trying to stop growth would be politically impossible. It would undermine support for cleaner and greener policies. And if you look at the living standards of people in the developing world, it would be unethical.
And just to clarify, the thesis is not that government should try to limit growth. It's that growth will be limited by factors including debt, resource overexpansion, et cetera. It's not that we will try to do it, it will happen because of forces.
There'll be some slowing down in growth because we've gone through a particularly rapid period with recovery after the Second World War in the rich countries, and then a period, China dates from Deng Xiaoping's more liberal policies in the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s. They're running, as it were, their course. The process of catch-up is it's not finished, but it, you know, as you get nearer, it's less powerful. So I think there are reasons to think, and you've got aging population in some countries too. So I think there are reasons to think that growth rates will slow down. But you keep coming back to the fundamental question, is breaking that link between consumption and production on the one hand and emissions on the other. That's the key story.
We're talking about the global economy with Nicholas Stern, former chief economist of the World Bank and a professor at the London School of Economics. Let's have our audience question. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you very much for a great show. I'm Warren Karlinzig, and I wanted to ask Professor Stern when he foresaw a global price on carbon being set, and what sort of indicators can we look at over the next few years that will indicate we're heading in that direction, besides just political will of leaders like Governor Brown, who's standing there? What are we looking for to get to that model?
Good examples. You've got seven provinces in China which are experimenting with carbon markets. You've got the example of California, you've got the northeast states. I hope that the European carbon market will be resuscitated. It was absurd that we let it collapse, and the basic reason, and you don't have to be a professor at the LSE to work out that if you give out too many permits, the price is going to crash. And when we had the recession and slowdown in Europe, that would have been the moment to reduce the number of permits. They didn't do that, and the price of carbon collapsed. So understand why that happens. I say you'd have to be very clever to work that out. So I think this is going to move forward with good examples. And I'm quite happy with a carbon tax. And if you ask me to choose between a carbon tax and a carbon market, I'd probably go for the carbon tax, but you know, I wouldn't get overexcited about it. Whichever seems to work best in the environment that you're in. So, I think we shouldn't give up hope. I mean, actually, we have an increasing number of examples. What we need is political determination to make them work well, and I think you're going to find that in California, I believe.
Let's have our next audience question from Nicholas Stern.
You talked about a lack of political will, and we know that the facts on science and climate science are here. So if the facts of climate science won't change political will, what will? And if not political will, then who's the most important party's mind to change?
I think you've got to do two things. It's crucial that people understand the risks. I mean, the risks, as we know, are colossal. These are existential risks for big parts of the world's population. We're the first generation which, through our negligence, could devastate the relationship between human beings and the planet. And we have to understand the consequences, the potential consequences of, you know, 3, 4, 5 degrees centigrade. And we look to the scientists to help us do that, and working with them, social scientists as well. So the first part of the story is making it clear that those risks are enormous. But that's not sufficient. The second part of the story is to be able to show that there are ways of changing that are actually very attractive. If you look at energy efficiency, if you look at renewables, alternative ways of doing things, if you look at stopping deforestation, what you'll see is a world that looks, in terms of its consumption and production, cleaner, quieter, safer, more biodiverse, and actually more community-oriented, because a lot of the things that we need to do, we're doing in a community. You can't reuse and recycle other than in a community. So a powerful description of what this alternative way of doing things looks like, and as we do that, I think we'll see that it's much more attractive than the old way of doing things. So you have to put those two things together. The second part of the story needs strong examples. And I think you're starting to get, in some cities, some sectors, examples of how that could work. But as I said, it needs courageous political leadership, it needs good teaching in schools, bring on the next generation. But we can't give up, we can't just say, oh, this political will stuff, it's all too difficult, it's not going to happen. Well, if that's what you really believe, you know, then get a hat and write a letter of apology to your grandchildren.
Nelson Mandela showed that impossible things can happen. Let's have our next question for Nicholas Stern.
Yes, thank you so much, sir, for coming all this way to speak with us. I'm Peter Joseph with Citizens Climate Lobby, trying to get a revenue-neutral carbon tax in through the United States Congress. Good luck. What I really want to know is what's going to happen with Downton Abbey and their financial situation. But more to the point...
I've got bored with Downton Abbey, but... I did watch it for a bit.
Many people say if we have a carbon tax in this country, it will disadvantage American industry because no one seems to understand the border tax adjustment. Could you educate us on how that might work? How, if the U.S. showed leadership, other countries might follow?
The first thing to understand is that for the vast majority of economic activity, the energy costs are modest. I mean, basic energy would be equivalent to about 5% of GDP. If you put that up, say, by 20% for a while, whilst you learn about these alternative technologies, that's a one-off 1% kick upwards in your costs. That doesn't lead people to move on scale. We looked in the Stern Review, other people looked at it. Environmental migration of industry is very limited if you look in the data. Why? Because there are other things that are much bigger. I mean, labor costs, labor productivity, real exchange rates, those are much bigger. The investment climate, how difficult it is to do business and so on. Those are the big things that determine where people locate. So it's really only for just three or four industries that the price of energy story is really significant. So the first thing to do is to really look at those competitiveness questions carefully, and when you do, you'll see that those arguments are really associated with a very narrow range of industries, and I think it would be quite wrong to let that tail wag the overall dog. So be more analytical, be more empirical. Most of the stuff about competitiveness is slogans without analysis and without detailed cost calculations. There will be some places, you know, like steel and aluminium and petrochemicals and paper. It really, they're only four or so, and they're not really big parts of the economy. Now, I don't want to say forget them, but it's much better to manage change in those areas rather than let the difficulty of change in those areas block progress on something as important as this. I do think that sometime down the track for countries or groups of countries to say that if you try to export stuff to us that's based on dirty production, then we have the right to take that into account at the borders. We do that with the environment. We do that with child labour and so on. Those are the kinds of things which are perfectly acceptable under the WTO. But I wouldn't want to rush there. It'd be very good if countries that are moving strongly said that, look, there's a group of us that are moving strongly. we have to say that 10 or 15 years down the track, if other people don't join us, if they insist on dirty methods of production, then they are subsidizing pollution by not charging for it. And we have to take that into account in the border tax adjustment. I've spent most of my life as an economist fighting protectionism. This actually isn't protectionism. It's correcting for the mispricing elsewhere.
We have a few minutes left, plus our next question. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, thank you for being here. My name is Lisa Hoyos, and I run an organization called Climate Parents. We're trying to mobilize parents as a strong political constituency for climate solutions. My question gets to what you've been saying about Nelson Mandela and the issue you raised regarding vengeance as it relates to fossil fuel executives versus another way to look at it, which is accountability, because these same characters, if you will, are funding and fleets, legions of lobbyists who I've encountered when we're, it's a David Goliath sort of reality when you're a climate advocate, a clean air advocate, versus a huge labyrinth of fossil fuel lobbyist power. So in California, we have AB 32, which the governor will hopefully talk about, our landmark climate policy, the only state that has it to scale in the U.S. Constantly, oil lobbyists are going after it. They try to restrain it, push it back, stop key pieces. So I was wondering if you revisited your question about how to deal with oil executives and fossil fuel executives. What's an accountability strategy that you think works? Because at the end of the day, they have so much money, and we have political will and organizing, but it's hard.
Thank you.
You have to get the incentives in society right. People react to the prices that they see. So given the incentive structures, if people react to them in legal ways, I don't think that you can make them villains. If they put money behind the spreading of lies about science, that seems to me a different kind of question and a different kind of accountability. But it's very difficult and in some cases dangerous to try to get too heavy and legal about that kind of thing. But how do you distinguish between somebody who's putting behind money behind a case that they really believe in and somebody who's being genuinely dishonest? Now, some of the time we think we can, but it's very hard to imagine a system which you'd find acceptable in terms of freedom that would easily distinguish between the funding of different kind of cases. Now, the question of lobbying is something for political systems to try to deal with. It is a big issue now in the UK, is how far and how much do we allow to be spent on lobbying. And I don't think there's an indefinite right to spend indefinite amounts of sums to try to persuade just a few people to vote this way or that way. But articulating that into a legal process is very hard. And I don't want to tell another country, I find it hard to work out how we should do it in my own country. So I think we have to be a bit careful about the way in which we treat people and the way in which we treat the legality of this. I think it's much better to actually win the argument and win the argument and create the political will by the quality of the arguments that you bring to the table. So I've not given up on democracy. I think we've got a good case and we make it well. Then we have a good chance. And that's where I would focus my energies. But I would deeply disapprove, and I think we ought to expose, those who put money behind telling lies.
We have time for one or two more brief questions and brief answers. Welcome to Climate One.
This one's pretty brief. My name is John Mashey. I have a UK-US political comparison question. In the US, we have plenty of think tanks which are public charities, tax-exempt. A whole lot of them are near K Street in Washington, and they've got actually a lot of economists in them, I'm afraid, that actually have a fair amount of influence, apparently, on the political process. The only one I know of like that in the UK is Lord Lawson's Global Warming Policy Foundation. Do they actually have any influence over there, or is that not anything?
Yeah, unfortunately, they do. You know, they... Unfortunately, they do, but and they don't disclose where they get their funding from. But, you know, they have a right to speak. Their arguments are pretty poor. And it's not too hard to show where they're wrong. And that's where we should focus our energies.
Next question. Welcome to Climate One.
I have a very difficult question for you. It seems that in order to incentivize businesses to change their way, maybe we have to show them how difficult it will be if we had a world with 4 degrees Celsius. The World Bank is concerned about a 4 degree Celsius world. Kevin Anderson's concerned about it. I've read Mark Linnaeus's book, 6 degrees, which is devastating to read. But if you look at the kinds of physical changes that will happen with a 4 degree Celsius world, can you give us an economic consequences to that so that that might incentivize people to understand just how disastrous that will be?
Well, there are a number of us who've tried to articulate what that might look like, and you know, some of the calculations in the Stern Review were exactly on that point. I think, by the way, most of the economic models understate the kind of damages that you would see at 4, 5, 6 degrees. I mean, 4 or 5 degrees is the difference between where we are now and the last ice age. Ice sheets came down, and forgive this version of latitude, the ice sheets came down to London, and people lived closer to the equator than that. That's telling us, surely, that changes of that magnitude are likely to involve massive movements of people, and massive movements of people are likely to involve severe and extended conflict. And you can't have a peace treaty in this case. You can't just turn it off. So I think we have to get much better at describing the kind of consequences of 4, 5, 6 degrees. But I think actually changing behavior will come through an understanding of what's responsible, and it will come through the kind of incentive structures that would be set up by a polity that really had understood not only the magnitude of the risks, but also the attractiveness of different ways of doing things. I think just by describing the risks alone, you'll get some change in behavior, but I don't think it'll be big enough to generate the kind of change that we need. You're going to need the policies as well. But an understanding of the risks can help generate the policies, but I've argued earlier, with that, you have to be able to describe and give examples on the very big changes that are necessary and why they look attractive. Discovery, innovation, cleaner, quieter, safer, more community-oriented, more biodiverse, and so on. So making that case is absolutely fundamental to getting change.
Nicholas Sternberg, at the end here, but before we close, I want to ask you, you've been doing this work for a long time, putting work on the cost of fossil fuels, et cetera. Often that's an abstraction for future generations. I'd like you to tell us briefly, you're a grandfather now, you have 2 young grandchildren, and how...
Three? Yeah.
Congratulations. How their presence motivates you and makes it real for you, this talk about future generations.
If you're talking about the conditions of life for people 50, 100 years from now, that's not some abstract future generation. You can look them in the eye. And their life should have at least equal weight with yours. And that should be reflected in the action, in your actions. I can't see any ethical reason for distinguishing between people's rights as individuals, the value of their lives, simply to do with the date of birth. And that, I think, is underlined very strongly to you when you look into your grandchildren's eyes.
We have to end it there. Our thanks to Nicholas Stern, former World Bank chief economist, chair of the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and Environmental and the Environment at London School of Economics, and winner of the 2013 Stephen Schneider Award here at Climate One. I'd like to thank you for coming, sir, and also thank you, our audience, here on the radio. I'm Greg Dalton, and this meeting of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is now over. Please stay seated. We are going to do a couple of things. First, I'd like to invite a member of the Schneider Award jury, Larry Goulder, to come up and introduce a brief video. So, Larry.
Well, thanks, Greg. The last book that Steve Schneider wrote was Science as a Contact Sport. and it talked about the various challenges that scientists faced, indeed the battles they often faced, when they went public and tried to convey their new ideas to the more general public. And most of the book was about the role of climate scientists, not just climate scientists, but other scientists as well. But in the last chapter of his book, he asked the question, what can the general public do to try to bring about a better world? And what he emphasized in that chapter was the importance of teaching the next generation, moving on and conveying to the next generation what this generation has learned. And he included in the chapter, at the end of the chapter, the book ends with the words to a song written by Graham Nash called Teach Your Children. Now, it turns out we have absolute proof that Nick is a fan of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. And it would have been nice to bring Graham Nash here to sing the song directly to Nick. I think that would have been a fitting way to finish this evening. Well, we weren't able to do that, but Greg, in his wisdom, when Graham Nash was here a few weeks ago giving a concert, he cornered Graham and said, we'd really like to regale you and to somehow get you involved. And so through Greg's work, they created a video, which you're going to see, which involves Teach Your Children. But as you'll see, it's a little different from the usual performance by Graham Nash. So here's the video.
You often end your concert with one of your famous songs, Teach Your Children. And now that you're a grandfather, we thought we would mix it up tonight and begin with a gift for you.
Oh. Oh, look at this. I can't wait to see what's going to go on here. Ah, guitars too. Hmm.
Let's
Very good.
Well, Lord Stern, on the day that the jury selected you as the winner of the Stephen Schneider Award for 2013, I met Graham Nash in New York, and I told him who the winner was, and he recognized immediately, oh, yes, he was very impressed. So he couldn't be here tonight, but he did sign this book for you. This is his memoir, and he wrote it to you. It's his tale of sex and drugs and rock and roll. But there's lots of good reading. It'll lift you up if you...
That's the Graham handshake. And to you.
I've had the honor of interviewing many governors, senators, cabinet secretaries, etc. on this stage. Only one has ever come here and sat in the back of class and learned and listened. It's my honor to introduce Governor Brown to come present the award.
Thank you.
We'll have to give it here. Well, I have a little award here. I think this is the globe itself, but it's the Nicholas Stern, the 2013 Stephen Schneider Award for Climate Science Communication. And there's a lot of science, but there's not a lot of good communication. We heard some of that tonight. So please keep it going. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I might say this is the place to get this award, because wherever you look around the world, California is a place of surprise and change and invention. And while this whole climate debate and turbulence has a lot of different forces and ideas, wherever I look, I see in this state, through many, many years, there are people pushing ahead, whether it's AB 32 or it's the energy efficiency standards or the renewable energy portfolio or all the various things they're doing. We got a long way to go. There's a lot of different views, but California has always been a dream standing out there, and I would hope that this award, with this great economist coming with his fine King's English, can inspire us to not be pushed back by the barriers and the propaganda and the inertia, but take some renewed energy that this is the state of the gold rush, Google and Twitter and all the other stuff, good and bad, that makes for waves and change. And tonight we're going to live up to this award and make California push all the more further and bring other states and other countries along with your ideas.
So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor. We also have, I believe there's one or two previous winners. I'd like to ask Dr. Jim Hansen, Dr. Richard Alley, two previous winners of the Stephen Schneider Award, to come on up here, close with the governor. Two other. Come on up.
That's a hard jump.
Thanks, Richard.
You can stumble on it.
Very nice to see you. Thank you very much. Thank you.